Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/ACAST, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi everyone, Amy here. Just a quick trigger warning for this episode. We talk about, because the documentary talks about, sexual assault, rape, domestic violence, and physical abuse. So if those things trigger you, please skip this episode. If you do stick around, enjoy the show. Welcome to Little Miss Recap, the podcast where we can't get enough murder. Can't get enough murder docs. Just can't. Can't stop, won't stop. My name's Amy Archer, and I'm here today with Jody Weber from Caught in My Web. And you are, Jody, tell everybody, you are a retired FBI?
That's correct. I spent 22 years as a special agent in the FBI. I worked in 3 field offices, Atlanta, Norfolk, Virginia, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Oh, wow. Okay, so where are you now? Where do you live now?
I live just south of Pittsburgh. I retired here 4 years ago, and I am full-time mom and podcaster.
Yay! Welcome to the club. I'm full-time
mom. Thank you for having me.
My girls are, I have twin daughters. They're 17. So like, I'm not really mom in a lot. You know
my
what I mean?
Twins will be 17 in May, and I have boy-girl twins. Oh! Yes. So we have a lot in common, Amy.
Yes. It's kind of a nightmare having 2 twin daughters. Like it's rough.
Well, I'll tell you, I am thankful I have one of each because I don't think they compete as much as other, you know, twins might who are the same gender. And, you know, I'll tell you, junior year is no joke.
No joke. And we're doing the college. Now, do your kids want to go to the same school? They're probably not as bonded as mine are because they're same sex.
They're extremely close, but they are completely different.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting, you know, because especially when you're the mother or the parent of twins, you say one thing and one takes it one way and one takes it completely the other.
Yes.
So it's just really interesting. But no, my kids probably will not go to the same school. They probably won't even be in the same state. Mm. But you know what? It's really good because they're expressing their independence.
Yeah, so. Mine too. They're both like, we need to get away from each other. We can't stand each other right now. Like, they're just, well, and it's so funny because when they were little, I was so grateful that I had girls because the energy of little boys is sometimes a little too much for me. Now I would kill for a teenage boy.
I have identical twins next door and they do room together in college.
Really?
They're afraid to be apart. And that almost concerns my neighbor.
Yes.
You know, the fact that, you know, girls, you can't be together forever. You're going to have to split eventually.
Yeah, unless they do like something on that show Smothered and they marry twin husbands and then they want to have babies at exactly the same time. It's real wild.
Which is a whole nother podcast.
A whole other podcast, a whole other thing. So I was telling you before we started, and I just want to tell my audience, I loved Jody when I heard her on Kate Casey really talking about Scott Peterson and this whole Innocence Project, the L.A. Innocence Project.
Yes. Thank you very much. Yes, I have some very definitive thoughts on Scott Peterson.
I immediately sent it to my mother, who is a lady of a certain age, sitting on her couch, retired, solving murders. And she was very interested in hearing that interview because she's in agreement. And I think that's where we landed, that I feel like Scott Peterson is guilty and he's right where he needs to be.
To me, I think people fall in one of three camps. Either they believe, yes, he was guilty, and yes, it was proven at trial. Mm-hmm. He's innocent and he got a raw deal. Or he's guilty, but the prosecution did not meet their burden.
Yes.
And, you know, I think it's hard in today's day and age where everything is so immediate and so digital and recorded and there's cameras and iPhones everywhere. I think it's hard for people to comprehend, especially who weren't necessarily adults when he went to trial, to understand how circumstantially for a jury means, motive, and opportunity were presented.
Right.
And many jurors felt, yes, he was guilty. In fact, unanimously, they all felt he was guilty. Yeah. Now, if he got a new trial in this day and age, would they be able to do the same thing? I'm not so certain.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. It was such a wild time. I just remember, you know, I was, what year was it, 2003 or four?
Yes. Yes.
So I was in my 20s and I just remember being fixated by it. I couldn't get enough of it. And then, you know, I don't know. I think I felt at the time that the media made the case that he was guilty. But as I started doing the research and we watched the, and I'm somebody who I can't just take one point of view. I have to watch like 10 documentaries on the same subject to see the different lens. I really felt like this is why I'm personally not a big fan of the death penalty, because I do believe if you feel like you got a raw deal at trial that you should receive an appeal if a court deems it. But, and so like, if they want to give him another, if they want to retry him, fine. But I think he is where he needs to be. I think he is guilty. That's my personal opinion.
Well, that's, I agree with you. I think he is as well. And I've said all along, you know, if by some chance this LA Innocence Project goes forward and they get the DNA testing they're requesting and they get to review evidence, even if it's a technicality that gets him a new trial. Mm-hmm. I do believe, you know, if I'm proved wrong, if there is some sort of, you know, DNA testing or some new evidence that wasn't presented previously that comes forward that exonerates him, I will eat my words.
Sure.
But as of right now, I'm pretty convinced they got the right guy.
Same, same. All right, so let's talk about a documentary where a case is not really made. Well, it kind of is, but it isn't. We'll talk about that at the end. So we're talking about The Truth About Jim 2024 on HBO Max, and it's a documentary that is filmed by Sierra Barter, who is the granddaughter in the story. And she has decided to make this, you know, four-part docuseries about her step-grandfather, Jim Mordecai. Now, what are your first impressions of this documentary? Because I had some issues with it structurally.
I agree. I had a hard time with the first episode to episode and a half. I felt that it was very heavily focused on sexual assaults, and trigger warning to your listeners, but a lot of coverage of sexual assaults that many participants in this documentary had experienced. Mm-hmm. And so you see a lot of that trauma, and it takes a while to really get to Jim and what the suspicions are or allegations are that they're going to launch against Jim, the step-grandfather. Mm-hmm. And so it was difficult because I wasn't sure if this was displaced trauma, where instead of holding the perpetrator for sexual assaults that Sierra had experienced, instead of holding them responsible, was she looking for someone else to hold responsible? So I was a little bit disoriented by the lack of focus, shall we say.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like it didn't know what it wanted to be. So the most interesting part of it to me was just as a memoirist and a writer and somebody who's interested in like human relationships, the most interesting part of it to me was the generational trauma and sexual assault.
Yeah.
But that's a different documentary.
Correct.
I feel like. So like it's a, I felt like it didn't know what it wanted to be. And I was interested in the Jim Mordecai stuff specifically because we had a very similar situation in my family. Not that we had a murderer in the family that I know of. I always say that I know of. However, my grandfather died very young and my grandmother remarried. And the man she remarried was a total, you know, abusive addict, you know, just real trouble. Bad. And it caused a rift between her and my mother. And we had a very similar situation. So I think I was kind of interested in seeing the story of these women and how they come back together. But again, that's a different documentary than they were framing it as.
Correct. And I think when I look at it, you see, as we eventually become introduced to Jim and his personality and the narcissistic characteristics of it, you see how he alienates the women in his life from their other family members.
Yes.
He did it with the second wife, mm-hmm. with their two biological daughters, Jamie mm-hmm. and Melissa. He alienated those girls against their mother.
Yep.
And then once he divorces Janae and he marries Judy, who is Sierra's grandmother, he really alienates Judy from her daughter, Shannon. And so that seemed yes. to be the common pattern of
yep.
him.
Yep.
So I yeah. thought that was interesting.
So let's talk a little bit about him. So in episode one, we are introduced to the family. So we have Sierra, her mother, Shannon, and then Shannon's mother, Judy. Sierra, we learn, was the victim of sexual assault when she was 18, and she was assaulted again years later. She wonders why she never reported this and why she never went to the police. And she says she thinks the answers to those questions are pointed to her family and their generational trauma. This is where we learn about Jim Mordecai, that, you know, they lived in fear from him for so long. Judy, her mother, had married Shannon's dad in college in their senior year. They lived in Half Moon Bay, which I'm obsessed with California. And when I see any little California town, I'm like, can I move there? Can I afford to move there? I will never be able to afford to move there, but it looked beautiful. And Judy says when Shannon's dad left, she had really low self-esteem. And Jim was Shannon's teacher, and he started to woo her. And then we have this, like, he was real big in the Future Farmers of America, which I'm like, that's okay. But, you know, sometimes we forget that Northern California is very agricultural-y.
Very yes. much so. Very mm-hmm. much so. Speaking of Scott Peterson, that area where right. they lived was very agricultural.
Yes.
He was a fertilizer yep. salesman. So, yes.
So he was problematic right from the start. He would flirt with Judy, but he would also like flirt with Shannon, and he would ask the rest of the class to grade her ass, and he tried to assault her in a greenhouse. Like he was just, she didn't like him immediately, this daughter. And he would, oh my God, this part was wild. He would have his little Jim Jones glasses on and he'd be in his little blow up hot tub. And students would come over there when they were drunk and like, quote unquote, sober up in his hot tub.
Did that blow your mind?
It blew my mind. But also, you know, I went to school in the 80s and 90s. And it was like teachers used to ask us to go down to the corner store and get them a pack of smokes. So.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, it was a different time. It was a different time.
So she said that Shannon tells us that there were rumors that Jim was sleeping with students. He'd call them sluts. Like we see his misogyny and his hatred of women very early on. And in many
ways. Very much. Yes. Then, sexism. Blatant.
Then she says, suddenly he's my stepfather. And I was
imagine what a nightmare that must have been.
Oh God. Like, cause at least when it happened to my mother was already married and out of the house. So like she didn't have to live with this guy. Do you know
right. But when it's your teacher who you don't like at school, and then you got to go to, you have to go home to that guy. Mm-mm. I just can't imagine the tension.
So Sierra goes over to her grandmother's house, Judy's, and Judy has a lot of guilt. She says when Shannon was little, she was there all the time. And it's this interview is interlaced with Shannon telling the story as well. And Shannon's like, when my mom, Judy, when I was little, she was there. She was baking cookies. She was picking me up from school. She was like mom of the year. And then she meets Jim and all of a sudden she just fucks off to his house and is like never around. And Shannon is pretty much left alone. And this is, like you said, the isolating.
Correct. And really what narcissists do, they want all the attention for themselves. They are the center of the universe.
Yep.
and everything else can fall by the wayside. And Judy capitulated.
Yeah, she did. So she said, Shannon says, then she had Sierra. And she realized that she was afraid that Jim would hurt Sierra. So she started pulling away from Judy as an adult then. And she says she feels like she taught Sierra that life was unsafe. And that is that cycle of generational trauma right there.
Absolutely. I have that in my notes as well. And ultimately, that's what leads Sierra to understanding, why am I not dealing with my sexual assaults? Why am I afraid to live? What am I afraid to face? And you're right. That really is the documentary within the documentary.
Yeah, which I loved. Like, I could have watched these three women. I probably sobbed harder in episode 4 at the end when she's having that conversation with Judy about, you know, or she's, Judy and Shannon are having a conversation and Judy's like, I know you thought I was weak and that, you know, I didn't protect you. And I'm like, oh, I'm like a sobber. So I was just sobbing hysterically. But that to me was so, just so poignant and so riveting. I couldn't look away from it. So we learn, like you said, about the sexual assaults, and there's a lot here, guys. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to go through all of it because it's, and I don't mean to sound reductive, but it is repetitive. You know, we see a pattern forming with how he corners these girls. He, you know, takes one to his ranch and he just is constantly molesting, grooming. He's gross. He's correct. He's a predator, essentially. Correct. So there's Jamie and Melissa. They're his daughters by his second wife. And when their mom, who is Janae, and he divorced, he said, I'm on a mission to find you a new mother. And so then came Judy.
Right.
And so I'm trying to think of this from Shannon's point of view. And she sees her mother leave. And now her mother's over there raising two other kids.
I know. And I found that interesting because she seemed to really like Jamie and Melissa, the other girls.
Yeah.
But she resented her mother. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty much not only for the attention given to another family, but really the attention given to Jim and the change.
Yep.
You know, not, why are you not hearing my concerns, Mom? That's what, you know, and when you think about a teenager, teenage girls can be difficult. The mother-daughter bond is difficult to begin with.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a whole library full of books on that subject. Mm-hmm. But then you add in all these other dynamics on top of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, she didn't feel heard. She didn't feel seen.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, I'm sure he knew what he was doing when he picked her. He saw that she was a single mother, struggling probably financially. And he does that a lot to a lot of his other kids. Like at one point, he's telling Jamie and Melissa, tell your mother that you hate her. And, you know, and if you like, who's going to want your mother if I'm not taking care of her? Like he uses this. I don't even know what I'm trying to say, like how to articulate it. But he manipulates these girls into thinking that their mothers need him.
Absolutely.
Because who's going to want a woman with four kids? She's, you know.
Well, and you look at that grandiose superiority and how delusional that is. That goes into his narcissism and his mental psychopathy. Yeah. And certainly the fact you see the alienation, that's classic alienation, like hate your mother. And that's weaponizing, that's using those girls as pawns.
It's gross. And it's gross. When I think it was Melissa was crying, remembering having to tell her mother that she hit. And Janae, of course, knew that this was coming from Jim, thankfully, and was like, I know you don't hate me. I know you don't hate me. And that probably, you know, helped. So we get a little bit in episode 2 of Jim's history. We learn that he was a star football player. So he you know, he had the warship, right, of the small town.
Yeah.
And he gets a full ride scholarship to UCLA. But then,
so that's talent.
Yeah, absolutely. And he had a real promising future ahead of him. But then he gets his girlfriend pregnant and he loses the scholarship. And it's unclear if he lost the scholarship because he had to get married or if, like, do they just not give you a scholarship because you got somebody pregnant? I'm unsure.
Well, it's interesting because I just covered another case. And in that same kind of time period, there was a police officer who was engaged and he was sharing a cabin with his fiance. and a guy broke into the cabin and sexually assaulted his fiance. So this cop arrests this guy. And the cop thinks, well, I'm going to get accolades at work because I not only made this arrest, but I, you know, this is against my fiance. Yeah. And the contrary happened. He almost got fired because he was sharing a cabin with a woman he wasn't married to.
Oh, wow.
I kind of see the correlation in this time period that maybe, you know, not being married and impregnating someone was looked down upon by the university, that that would be, you know, a blemish on their reputation.
That's a good point, because it had to have been, he was born in 1941, so it had to be in the early 60s.
Right, right. Absolutely. Around that time period.
Yeah, absolutely. So he was angry about this, and Judy thinks that that may have shaped his view towards women, but we also learn later that he had a very bad relationship with his mother, that his mother was overbearing, really strict, and not very nurturing. So there's also that issue. We learned that he had a ranch where he brought girls and tried to rape them. One girl went to a school counselor and they fired Jim and he never taught again. But that didn't happen until, you know, he had a lot of time to groom these girls.
Correct. Correct.
So then we see the scene. This was interesting. Shannon goes on her school alum page and is like, hey, guys, anyone else out there? You know, was your life made a nightmare by my stepfather, and people attack her.
Very much so. And, you know, this is what I find interesting about this part, because, you know, we saw the same thing in the Catholic priest scandal or in the Jerry Sandusky case, where there are all these people who say, oh, no, that father, he was excellent. He was wonderful to me. Mm-hmm. Or Jerry was a wonderful coach.
Mm-hmm.
It's the vulnerable ones, the ones that are groomed, the ones that are personally selected and are isolated. The general masses don't necessarily see the nefarious activity that's going on behind the curtain.
I think we see a lot of this with, like, I'm thinking immediately of the Bill Cosby situation.
Another perfect example.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like America's dad or whatever. And it's like, no, no.
Correct. How they're curated isn't necessarily who they are in truth.
Yeah, absolutely. So now we have the introduction of the Santa Rosa hitchhiker murders. And they took place from 1972 to 1973. And at the end, I want to save it for the end, but at the end, I want to ask you, like, what you think about this. But I'll just go through what is going on here. So this guy hogtied people, put them in ditches. And this is exactly what Jim used to talk about. The girls were the ages around 12, 13, 15, the same age that Jim liked to assault. They were from, quote unquote, broken homes. I hate that term, but that's what they were from. And in 1972, when this happens, Jim is going through a divorce with his first wife, is in a dark place, and his ex-wife moves to Santa Rosa, and he's doing a lot of, as you would, like a road trip to stalk people. And I could totally see this guy doing this. And he's using the 101 to get back and forth. And that's where a lot of these girls go missing, along the 101. Jim grew up in Santa Rosa, so he would really know the area well. And there were 8 girls killed in 2 years. So at the end of episode 2, we meet Deb Rosa, who's a woman who's trying to keep, you know, find justice for these girls and keep them in the spotlight. And Sierra goes out to see her and they talk to a woman named Mary, who's an eyewitness. And she describes the guy that the 2 victims went with. And she says he was much older. She says he looked more like a teacher to me than a student.
I thought that was interesting.
That was chilling.
Of any words to pick, that she would pick those words.
Yep. She said he had short, dark hair and he was slender, 5'10", wearing a denim jacket. We see a picture of Jim wearing a denim jacket. And she shows her a picture and Mary's like, oh, like that really looks like him. So that's how we left episode 2. And I agree with you. That's where I was like, oh, this is getting interesting now.
Well, and interesting too was the fact that Mary says her friends meet this guy and he portrayed himself as, hey, I've got pot. Why don't you come with me? Mm-hmm. And so the 2 friends go, but Mary doesn't. And she never saw these 2 friends again, Yvonne and Maureen.
Yes.
And one of the newspapers says that one of the earrings was missing from one of the victims. And as we're watching through this documentary, we find out that Shannon had found this jewelry box in Jim's belongings with these odd items of jewelry that look more like teenagers' jewelry than real jewelry store jewelry, if you will.
Yep.
And there would be, you know, one earring or a mismatched set of something. And she couldn't figure out, why does he have this jewelry? And then they find this news article that says one of the victims was missing an earring. And when Shannon hears about this newspaper article, she said, no, I know there was an earring like that in that jewelry box I found.
That was chilling. Because we know that sometimes serial killers do this, right?
They keep souvenirs.
Souvenirs. Ugh. So episode 3, we meet Michael Probst, who was Janae's kid by her first marriage. And when Jim became his stepfather, he was an abusive nightmare. He made him beat people up. My heart broke for Michael.
He was such a nice guy. And you could just tell that's not how he's wired to be that way.
No. Jim made him like go and beat up a kid who was bullying him. And Michael, he's moved to tears. And he's like, that's just not who I am. Like, I'm not a violent person. He takes Michael out on drive one day and shows him where they found the dead body of a girl who was nude and hogtied. Then we see Sierra going to meet with Nina Hobson, who's a private investigator, and she lays out the case for Nina. And there's this really interesting scene where they have this map, and Sierra's putting all these little stickers where these 8 girls were found, and then she draws a red X where Jim's ranch was, and it's all pretty close.
Correct. And I mean, I think that really showed the homework Sierra had done. Like, this isn't just a willy-nilly suck out of my thumb kind of mm-mm, thought. Mm-mm. She really did her research, and he was in proximity to all these different crime scenes and all these victims.
Sierra did a lot of work. And it's funny because I was talking to my mom about this documentary, and she's like, I loved it so much because that girl reminds me of you. She goes, if I'm murdered, I know you'd solve it. I'm like, okay, Mom, I'll solve your murder.
Well, hopefully it'll never come to that.
So now we see that Jim gets cancer, and the women, it's interesting because there's finally like this sense of safety around them. And they're like, even Judy is like, I can breathe again, like not knowing he's, and something that I'm kind of skating over, but if you watch the documentary, you'll see it. Like, the abuse that Judy suffered was constant. And we learn little bits and pieces. He slammed her car in a trunk once. He, you know, flipped over a table on Janae. Like, the abuse that he put his wives through was just constant. We learn that Judy and Shannon's relationship ended after a harrowing drive home with Jim. Yes. So at one point, Shannon is a young mother. She has Sierra. She has to live with Judy and Jim, and it's not clear why, probably because she's a single mother and she's raising her child, and she's finishing up her school, and Jim is driving her back and forth from class, and one night he's driving her home. And this is another thing that is brought up repeatedly in the documentary, is that Jim seemed to have like a switch that would flip.
Yes.
And so he would go into this other zone, and so he's driving her home, and he cuts off the main road, and he starts flying through these side roads, and he's like, she could tell he's really in a different place. And she, I forget what she says to him, but she somehow snaps him out of it. And she gets home and she's like, I'm done. And she takes Sierra and she leaves, and they didn't talk for 10 years.
Correct. Correct.
Wild. Hey everyone, stay tuned. Little Miss Recap will be right back after these words.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
So then we get the documentary goes in this place where they think he might be the Zodiac. What are your thoughts on this?
That's where I thought the documentary took a little bit of a left turn. Because after Shannon tells us about this horrifying drive home with Jim, Sierra says, well, I'm going to research and see if anybody else got, you know, a horrifying ride home and jumped out of a car. And she finds some sort of similar occurrence. And that victim who allegedly jumped out of some other perpetrator's car went into the police station and looked up at a bulletin board and said, oh, that's the guy that had me, the Zodiac killer.
Right.
So from that random statement, Sierra makes the connection. Well, maybe Jim wasn't just the Santa Rosa hitchhiker killer. Maybe he was also the Zodiac killer. And that's kind of where I thought that may be a bit of a stretch.
Yeah. And I see like a lot of people online are ripping this part apart. And they're just like, why would they think you? But in the beginning, Shannon has a good point. And she's like, I know it sounds wild, but like somebody's father is the Zodiac. Or you know what I mean? And I'm like, well, not necessarily. He might not have kids, but he is somebody's relative.
Correct. Somebody's son, sibling, somebody's next door neighbor, etc. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So, and then finally in episode 4, they meet with Ray Carr, who's a retired FBI profiler. And he tells them the Santa Rosa killer has the following characteristics. Because, oh, I didn't say this, but the Zodiac thing is shot down.
Correct.
By an expert. He's like, no, not happening. So Ray Carr says, here is the profile that I have come up with for the Santa Rosa killer. White male, mid to late 20s, worked with kids as a teacher or counselor. Familiar with the area, maybe experimented with animals, very confident in talking to young women. Might seem like a nice guy who could snap, probably a rapist, and may have been a voyeur. And then we do learn that he used to watch Shannon with her boyfriends. And then he says, probably collected souvenirs.
Yes. I have to say, I was really impressed with this former profiler, and I've had experience with profilers. Mm-hmm. And to me, they're either fantastic or they're not fantastic. There's like one extreme or the other. And I thought he was very methodical and reasoned. And I didn't get any egotistical sense from him where like, well, I'm going to tell you who this is. You know, he's like, look, this is what I see. These are, you know, my, what I view to be a realistic characteristic of who this person would be, what sort of occupations you would find him in, what sort of behavior patterns I would anticipate. Mm-hmm. So I found him to be very, very credible.
Okay. I liked him too. And we have to remember that even though we watched the documentary, presumably he's going into this cold, not knowing Jim Mordecai and what he comes up with. Wow.
Correct. It's really, and chilling. You know, I'll give a shout out. There is another retired FBI agent by the name of Julia Cowley, and she has a podcast called The Consult Podcast, and it's all FBI former profilers. And I am a fan of hers. I will give her 5 stars. So if anybody's interested in profiling in cases that former FBI profilers have looked at, the Consult Podcast is a very good one.
I'm so interested in profiling just because I'm interested in human dynamics. So I'm really interested in that field. I think it's so fascinating.
Well, you can really learn a lot by behaviors and talking to people and finding out what are people's fatal flaws? Like, what are their tics? Mm-hmm. What gives them, you know, a sense of accomplishment? What gives them a sense of irritation? And you can kind of really learn a lot about people based on their psychology and what they would be apt to do based on their personality.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was, did you see, I'm sure you watched it already. What was the show? Was it on Netflix? Was it Manhunt? No, it wasn't Manhunt. It was the one where we learn about how they caught the guy from Atlanta who was killing people.
Blood Mountain?
No, it's, oh shit, this is going to bother me. It's where we learn how they established the behavioral analysis unit.
Oh, okay. Okay, sure. Sure.
I have to look it up now.
With John Douglas.
Netflix. Georgia Murder. It's like right on the tip of my tongue. Oh, I'm not. Oh, shit. It's not Manhunt. Mindhunter. Thank you.
That's okay. That's all right. Yes.
It's Mindhunter. What did you think of that show?
I watched several of the episodes of the first season of that. Mm-hmm. And basically what it is, it's a guy in the FBI who got the idea that, hey, if I go interview all these perpetrators and find out what their motivations are, I'll be better able to identify this mm-hmm. if I come across this in the future. And, you know, it kind of raises a lot of like red flags right now because Brian Koberger was asking people to fill out his surveys. Yes. Tell me what you were thinking about when you were doing your crimes.
Yes.
Well, is it because he had an interest in law enforcement or because he was thinking about committing crimes himself? That's the million-dollar question right now.
Yeah, that case is wild.
It sure is, isn't it?
Is there a good documentary about that we know of?
No, there is a documentary out. I wouldn't necessarily know if I'd say it's good. It's a lot about the social media coverage of that case and how it has inflamed a lot of rumors and speculation and both positive and negative impacts of the social media coverage.
Yeah.
And certainly there are some fascinating aspects as far as, you know, was he Papa Roger and was he in chat rooms and that sort of thing. But then there's also, you know, kind of the negative side as to all the speculation about the roommates and some things that haven't been validated about, you know, why the roommates didn't call and, you know, what were they under the influence and, you know, a lot of speculation and people forget that the roommates are also true victims in this.
Absolutely. It's so fascinating to me now that we have social media introduced into all of these cases. Like we saw it with Gabby Petito.
Yes, very much. And, you know, there the public really does help.
Yeah.
So it's a double-edged sword. It really is. But certainly when we look at, you know, this case, social media has commented as well, especially about the Zodiac part.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So it kind of wraps up in episode 4 with them getting a DNA profile built of Jim Mordecai. And they use a bunch of different things, a knife that he has, a watch that he wore, his clippers from his hair. So they're able to develop a DNA profile. And then we see the last scene is Nina Hobson accompanies Sierra to the Sonoma County Sheriff's Office. And she presents the case. She presents the DNA profile. Now they have DNA from the Santa Rosa
Correct.
Killer.
From at least 2 victims, there was semen.
So that's kind of the end of the doc. But this is where I wanted to have a discussion with you of, I have a couple questions. Number one is, why haven't they tested that DNA yet? We see this a lot with murder cases, right? Like they have DNA, but we see somebody like Kelly from Cold Justice who has to go around and like beg them to test other DNA. Is testing DNA expensive? Okay. So that's what the issue is here.
Well, I think it could be one of 2 things. One, it is expensive for these local departments. They can't just test every time some Tom, Dick, and Harry comes in off the street and says, here's some DNA, run it against what you have.
Right.
Because remember, they've got a limited amount of sample. So they got to make sure that if they're going to test it, one, that they don't use up a lot of their sample, but number 2, that there's enough sample left for eventual defense should this ever go to trial someday.
Okay.
So that's an issue. Cost is an issue. These departments don't have, you know, an endless supply of money.
Would you say
money.
It's like a cost in the thousands? Are we talking?
Oh, yes. Yes. Okay. All yes. Right. And then I think also you got to remember, had it been negative, had they tested it and it was negative, we would know. So either they haven't tested it or they have tested it, but their prosecutor wants to cross all T's and dot all I's and see, all right, well, we got 2. Can we connect 2 other? Because you don't necessarily want to let the cat out of the bag right away.
Right.
Because if there is other evidence to obtain, you don't want it destroyed while you're still trying to build the rest of the case. So it could be they're working on it And we just don't know that yet.
But it also could be that they haven't tested it at
Correct.
All.
Correct. It could be either way.
I mean, Nina seemed, and I know she's a private investigator, but, you know, I'm sure she knows her stuff. She seemed really impressed with the case that Sierra presented. So when you look at this case through, I have here, like, could Jim be a murderer? Okay. All these women described the switch that would flip. He's a serial rapist. We see he had a hatred for women. He has also this weird relationship with religion where he talks in tongues. He talks about himself as a savior. He used to say he was Moses reincarnated. Okay, dude. She finds the jewelry box that seems to match a description, like you said, of an earring. He had a habit of taking long drives. Mary was the eyewitness. So we have a lot of, but what do we need? We need means, motive, and opportunity.
Correct.
In your opinion, do you think he meets any of those three?
Well, I certainly think he's got the behavior profile to escalate. I mean, if you're willing to commit violent sexual assaults, I don't think it's that big of a jump to go to the next level, which is killing someone, especially if those victims are fighting back.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, to me, I think a propensity to violence, he certainly has demonstrated that. He seems to have the behavior where he likes to dominate and control and alienate. Mm-hmm. So would he isolate women? Would he groom women? Would he target women who are vulnerable? Well, we've seen that pattern of behavior. So I would say, yes, he would. Opportunity, he's in proximity. And Sierra did an excellent job of putting that all together. Now, I do think two things really, really jumped out at me. Number one, all the references from the various family members of him constantly using the term hog tying.
Right.
That to me really jumped out. And then the fact that Michael said that he drove him by that one crime scene where mm-hmm. a victim's body was left and he specifically says she was hogtied. To him, to me, I almost wonder if he had some sort of erotic fascination with hogtying yeah. and it was a sexual stimulus for him while committing a crime. And so to me, that really seemed significant. The fact that all these family members remember that. And it was so prolific that it happened so often. The fact he would mention, because that's not a word. I mean, I don't think I've ever used that word in my life.
No, certainly not.
It's an odd, unique characteristic. But then I think to me, the biggest tragedy, well, not the biggest tragedy, the biggest tragedy is the murder victims and the sexual assaults. But the biggest, I think, loss as far as evidence is that jewelry box.
I know. And you could see Shannon is like kicking herself because she says she just threw it away or gave it away.
I know. And if you had that, you'd know. You'd know. Yeah.
How were the girls, how were they murdered? Do we know this? Did I miss that? Were they strangled?
I was thinking that. I'd have
so they
to go
don't
back.
Make it very clear.
They
don't
make it clear. But I do think...
Because he had a lot of guns. They talk about a lot of guns.
But, you know, we don't hear anything about ballistic matches or, you know, casings found or anything like that.
No.
We have semen on at least two of the hitchhiking victims. And I think, quite frankly, what I think is, will a local department compare Jim's DNA and spend the money that way? Or would they be better off spending the money on investigative genetic genealogy and taking that semen and building the family skeletons? And then once they work through and break it down, like, okay, who is a male in this area that is in this family? And does it fit any of the suspects that have been brought to us by the Sierras of the world?
That's a really good idea. Maybe that's what they're doing.
That's what I'm kind of wondering is that, you know, that may have already been in the works before Sierra ever knocked on their door.
Yeah.
Because after the Golden State Killer case, Mm-hmm. People were like, look, this is the wave of the future. And certainly we're seeing it across the board. We're seeing it with Koberger. We're seeing it with Gilgo Beach. We're seeing that this is the way cases are going to be worked. And it's helping solve so many sexual assault cases from years ago and finding serial offenders. And certainly I think a lot of these unsolved murders are also being solved through genetic genealogy with DNA that's left behind. And DNA, the collection of it, it is just exponentially improving, even in just the past few years with this MVAC machine that's like a wet vacuum. That collects even more microscopic DNA than even touch DNA. I mean, it's finding things that couldn't be found even 5 years ago. So I really think that's the wave of the future. And if I were a local department, would I test every time someone came in and said, hey, I had a stepfather or I had a grandfather, or would I spend my money doing investigative genetic genealogy? I would do the IgG. That would be the route I'd go.
Yeah, that would seem to make sense, because then you would have, then you take that suspect and you compare it against everybody who's come in. That seems to be the better. Is it way more expensive though? Or is
it's expensive. It is expensive. However, there are so many nonprofits and people who are willing to donate to such causes, especially when you've got multiple victims, like this hitchhiker case.
I can see the families maybe coming together and
like, let's do GoFundMes and all the money can be dedicated towards IgG on these semen samples. And let's see what we can get. Can we build some family skeletons and narrow this down? I think the hitchhiker case is solvable. Whether it's Jim Mordecai or not, I don't know.
Does your gut lean one way or another if it's Jim Mordecai?
I am in line with the profiler. I do not think he can be eliminated. I don't think this is just women who have been victimized and are pointing fingers randomly at, under misguided reasons. And to me, I don't know if you saw The Keepers, the documentary on The Keepers about the nuns and Sister Kathy.
That was,
to me, there's a lot of parallels, because there were a number of victims at that Catholic school, but then there were others who were like, what are you talking about? I had a great high school experience.
Yeah. Yep.
And so to me, it was very, very similar. And you know, there's been questions all along. Why, you know, if there was DNA found on a cigarette, why is this not being done through IgG?
Right.
And I almost think, you know, I almost think now that people know that there's DNA, there's more pressure to do all these techniques.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Huh. I wonder too, if this is going to be the wave of the future where you have family members starting to come forward building their own cases, because now Sierra knows how to build a case because she's probably watched a million murder docs, as we all have. And so it kind of, like Gabby Petito, kind of turns us all into these amateur detectives. Does that help or hurt, though, is my thing. I think it could hurt in many places.
Well, I mean, I know from my experience in law enforcement, especially once CSI and Law and Order and those types of shows became so prolific, and people were watching multiple shows a week where, you know, the crime is solved within an hour. When I would go to trial, they would think everything's recorded and that there's a video of everything. And, you know, we see it a lot with the talk about Scott Peterson. Yeah. And it's like, look, you don't necessarily have foreign DNA or foreign fibers or foreign hair or, you know, some camera video. And certainly not back in 2002, 2003 time period. I mean, now, now there's Ring cameras everywhere. There's Amazon trucks with cameras in them everywhere. We have people with cell phones. I mean, everybody walks around with literally a camera and a video recorder in their hands now. So it's a different world. So yes, in some ways that is so beneficial. And I certainly saw when the Boston Marathon bombing happened, there's a lot of parallels between that case and when I worked the Centennial Olympic bombing in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. When we were collecting photographs and videotape from Centennial Park, they were Kodak film pictures. Wow. It wasn't, you know, people didn't have cell phones. And if they did have a cell phone, it was the size of a shoe. It wasn't, you know, the size of your iPhone.
Right.
So when Boston bombing happened, they were inundated with video footage, almost to the point where there's so much they couldn't get through it all.
Right. One of the things I've seen online, one of the criticisms of this documentary is, and this drives me mad, is, but he doesn't have a criminal record. A lot of serial killers don't have a criminal record.
That's exactly right.
Like, you're not a criminal until you are.
Well, that's like exactly. I used to say that about bank robbers all the time. Every bank robber is not a bank robber until they rob their first bank.
Right. So, like, I think that drives me crazy, but please speak to that. Like, we see this a lot, right? Where somebody could be operating for years and not be caught.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the joke in the FBI was, well, we don't catch the smart ones. We catch the dumb ones.
Right.
We catch the ones that make the mistakes. So, yes, there are those that, especially the lone wolves, the loners, the ones who aren't social, that don't want the attention. I mean, that's part of the reason the Unabomber for years went undetected.
That was fascinating, that case.
And again, that was women that really, I mean, if you really do the research on the Unabomber case, there are a lot of guys that get credit for it, but it's the women. It's the women behind the scenes that put two and two together. The wife, the professor, the female agent. Behind the scenes, women put that together.
Yeah. Well, there are some things that I wanted to end on that I did like in this documentary. I like to end on positive notes. So what I loved about it were the conversations between Sierra and Judy, her grandmother. So heartwarming. Sierra saying, no matter what happens, the women in my family are finally able to put Jim Mordecai behind us and talk and heal. And Judy and Shannon talking, like I said earlier, was riveting to me when Judy said, you know, I know you saw me as weak. And Shannon says to her, I did, but I also know that you were acting with learned patterns, which I thought was really interesting. Because Judy says, like, I was raised to, you obey your husband.
Yes, the self-actualization is just really, I mean, and, you know, I would say this to anyone who is listening that's a trauma victim or has experienced alienation and has been estranged due to, you know, someone with a narcissistic personality like Jim Mordecai. You can come back together and you can heal. And I have seen it, and you can end up stronger and have a better bond because, you know, it takes a while, but once the self-actualization happens between the multiple victims, it's a bond that can't be broken because suddenly you recognize, you know, you don't know how toxic your environment is until you're almost removed from it. And that's what we really see. It took Jim dying of cancer and then being removed from that toxicity to finally be able to realize, holy cow, the rest of, you know, everybody else isn't dealing with what we were dealing with. You know, this is so, you know, toxic. And we, when you're in that kind of forest, you don't, you can't see the forest from the trees, so to speak.
Yeah. When you're isolated, you really think I am the only person going through this.
Yes.
And if you're somebody, you know, who has been assaulted, you think you are the broken part. Like this is something in you is broken and this is what's going on. And to just take all those broken pieces together and heal together is so, I loved it. I love that end scene where they all go to Michael's house, all the siblings, and they're just, you know, we're a family and this is it. And it just really, I was riveted by that whole like subplot. I just wish it was either separated out or maybe the first two episodes dedicated to that. And I don't know. It just was structured not in a great way.
I think that was my biggest problem with this documentary is the way it was produced. And as a writer, you understand, like, you know, the sequencing wasn't, it was out of order.
Yes. Yeah. Drives me crazy. So let me ask you, what are some of your favorite murder documentaries or shows that you can recommend to my audience who love a good murder show?
Okay, so we've had a few really good ones this year already. First off, American Nightmare on Netflix.
We covered that. That was wild.
That is fascinating. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you talk about, frankly, I think that Detective Mustard should have been fired. I mean, the comments he made to those sexual assault victims.
He's gross.
It was disgusting.
He's gross.
And again, hats off to the female detective. Thank God for her.
Yep.
So that is excellent. If you haven't watched American Nightmare on Netflix, another one I recommend is Blood Mountain. And that involves a serial killer that was going through multiple jurisdictions in Northern Georgia, North Carolina, and Florida. And it's not the flashiest documentary, but it is riveting because it is literally a boots on the ground look at how all these different departments in multiple jurisdictions were working their murders, suspecting they had a serial killer, how they all came together, what the prosecutors had to do, what their worries were, and then are there other victims of the serial killer, and what other cases do they think are tied to it? It's really good. So I recommend that one.
Let me ask you this about Blood Mountain. And you don't have to, this is not a spoiler, but is it a cold case still or is it solved?
It's solved.
Okay. Because I'm like so weird about cold cases. I need to know they're solved.
This one is solved.
Okay.
Yes. All right. This one is solved. And there are several, I should say, there are several murders that were solved. So you will get satisfaction.
Okay.
But there are other killings that they think this perpetrator may have done. They just can't definitively say for sure or not.
Gotcha.
But to me, I can see why they're included in the documentary.
Okay.
So I think people, if you are a person who enjoys true crime documentaries, I really enjoyed that one. I thought it was very well done and very well plotted out the way they present it to you. So I think that one's good. And then certainly there's some classics. You know, if you haven't watched The Jinx with Robert Durst.
I have not watched that.
Oh,
I need to put that on my
list.
Oh, I've been meaning to get to that and I haven't.
That is a really good one. And when you see when he talks to himself in third person, I mean, chills. So I would recommend that one. That's one of my top ones as well.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it. We're always looking for good murder docs.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, you can learn a lot.
Yeah.
You can learn a lot from these documentaries and, I don't, you know, people make fun of women who are true crime obsessed and watch the Datelines and the 2020s. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh no, that's how you stay safe.
Yes.
That's how you protect yourself.
Yes.
So don't ever apologize for watching.
I'm going through this with my daughters. I'm always like, you know, I'm a nervous wreck. If you run out of gas and we live in a very rural area in Northeast Pennsylvania. And I'm always like, if you run out of gas and you don't have signal, here's what you need to do. Like, I'm always crazy about that stuff because I've seen a murder show about it. I know this is when you're vulnerable. Like, we know now what the risk factors are and what engaging in risk behavior, which to women is like walking down the street alone. You know, men will never understand that, but that is risk behavior for us.
Correct.
We know now like what that looks like and how to prevent putting yourself in a vulnerable position, but you know, they still get to us.
Well, anyone, I would recommend to all women, whatever your age is, I've given this to my daughter and I've given it to my mother. I get birdie alarms, you know, have them on your keychain, have them on your purse. You know, it's a simple little device. You just, it literally is maybe the size of a cigarette lighter and you just pull it apart. And it sets off an alarm and it can really, you know, help you if someone's trying to steal your purse, if someone you feel uncomfortable, if they're invading your personal space, pull that. What's the worst that can happen? They get mad at you because you're making a noise. I mean, it's a great way to alert people that you could be in danger.
I'm ordering one right now. I bought the mace, but I feel like that's not enough.
Well, and I, on my website, jodeneweber.com, I'm an Amazon associate and I link to safety products for people, whether it's for your home or your personal safety. And one of the products I have on there is spray, pepper spray and spray gel. And okay. some people like the spray gel better because it doesn't aerosolize back at you if there's mm-hmm. a wind gust. Mm-hmm. But it never hurts to have some mace or some pepper spray or pepper gel.
Absolutely. All right, Jody. Well, thank you so much for joining us, for sharing your expertise. So you're south of Pittsburgh. Are you near Falling Water?
Not far. Yes.
Okay. I've always wanted to make a trip out there to see it. My daughter, I think, is going to look at Pittsburgh, University of Pittsburgh. Okay. So I said, when I go out, I want to, because I've been in Pittsburgh a few times, but I have never made it to see Falling Water. And I really want to
see it. Well, yes. And, you know, also out this way is the Flight 93 Memorial. That's about an hour east of me. Yeah. I'm literally halfway between Pitt and the University of West Virginia. Okay. So, you know, you could go either way from my house. but yes, I'm Southwest Pennsylvania and, you know, I didn't know you were also in Pennsylvania.
Yeah,
so
yeah. I'm about 10 minutes north of Scranton.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So. Very well. Yes.
Yep. Tell everybody where they can find you and what you're doing on your podcast.
Yes. You can find my podcast 5 days a week on patreon.com. I cover breaking true crime news. And then twice a month on the weekends, I have a bonus tier where I cover cold cases that are unsolved. I dig into those, try to tell you, you know, what I think, how they can be solved, that sort of thing. So that's called Caught in My Web. It's on patreon.com. I'm on Twitter at Jodine Weber, TikTok Jodine Weber, Facebook Jodine Weber, and Instagram is Weber Jodine.
All right. Awesome. I hope that you'll come back again.
Oh, I would be honored to. Thank you so much.
And
Amy,
we could absolutely solve another murder. Not that we Sounds solved great. This, but we could try.
And we can talk twins.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.